Page 11, Chapter 1, The Earth. 1. The Starting Point. One night when I had tasted bitterness, I went out onto the hill. Dark heather checked my feet. Below marched the suburban street lamps. Windows, their curtains drawn, were shut eyes, inwardly watching the lives of dreams. Beyond the sea's level darkness, a lighthouse pulsed. Overhead, obscurity. I distinguished our own house, our islet in the tumultuous and bitter currents of the world. There, for a decade and a half, we two, so different in quality, had grown in and into one another for mutual support and nourishment in intricate symbiosis. There daily we planned our several undertakings and recounted the day's oddities and vexations. There letters piled up to be answered, socks to be darned. There the children were born, those sudden new lives. There, under that roof, our own two lives, recalcitrant sometimes to one another, were all the more thankfully one larger, more conscious life than either alone. All this, surely, was good, yet there was bitterness. And bitterness not only invaded us from the world, it welled up also within our own magic circle. For horror at our futility, at our own unreality, and not only at the world's delirium, had driven me out onto the hill. We were always hurrying from one little urgent task to another, but the upshot was insubstantial. Had we, perhaps, misconceived our whole existence? Were we, as it were, living from false premises? And in particular, this partnership of ours, this seemingly so well-based fulcrum for activity in the world, was it, after all, nothing but a little eddy of complacent and ingrown domesticity, ineffectively whirling on the surface of the great flux, having in itself no depth of being and no significance? Had we perhaps, after all, deceived ourselves? Behind those rapt windows did we, like so many others, indeed live only a dream? In a sick world even the hale are sick, and we too, spinning our little life mostly by rote, seldom with clear cognizance, seldom with firm intent, were products of a sick world. Yet this life of ours was not all sheer and barren fantasy. Was it not spun from the actual fibers of reality, which we gathered in with all the comings and goings through our door, all our traffic with the suburb and the city and with remoter cities and with the ends of the earth? And were we not spinning together an authentic expression of our own nature? Did not our life issue daily as more or less firm threads of active living and mesh itself into the growing web, the intricate, ever-proliferating pattern of mankind? I considered us with quiet interest and a kind of amused awe. How could I describe our relationship even to myself without either disparaging it or insulting it with the tawdry decoration of sentimentality? For this, our delicate balance of dependence and independence, this coolly critical, shrewdly ridiculing, but loving mutual contact, was surely a microcosm of true community, was, after all, in its simple style, an actual and living example of that high goal which the world seeks. The whole world? The whole universe? Overheard obscurity unveiled a star. One tremulous arrow of light, projected how many thousands of years ago, now stung my nerves with vision and my heart with fear. For in such a universe as this, what significance could there be in our fortuitous, our frail, our effervescent community? But now, irrationally, I was seized with a strange worship, not surely of the star, that mere furnace which mere distance falsely sanctified, but of something other, which the dire contrast of the star and us signified to the heart. Yet what could thus be signified? Intellect, peering beyond the star, discovered no star-maker, but only darkness. No love, no power even, but only nothing. And yet the heart praised. Impatiently I shook off this folly and reverted from the inscrutable to the familiar and the concrete. Thrusting aside worship and fear also and bitterness, I determined to examine more coolly this remarkable us, this surprisingly impressive datum which to ourselves remained basic to the universe, though in relation to the stars it appeared so slight a thing. Considered even without reference to our belittling cosmical background, we were, after all, insignificant, perhaps ridiculous. We were such a commonplace occurrence, so trite, so respectable. We were just a married couple, making shift to live together without undue strain. Marriage in our time was suspect, and ours, with its typical romantic origin, was doubly suspect. We had first met when she was a child. Our eyes encountered. She looked at me for a moment with quiet attention, even, I had romantically imagined, with obscure, deep-lying recognition. I, at any rate, recognized in that look, so I persuaded myself in my fever of adolescence, my destiny. Yes, how predestinate had seemed our union. Yet now, in retrospect, how accidental. True, of course, that as a long-married couple we fitted rather neatly, like two close trees whose trunks had grown upwards together as a single shaft, mutually distorting, but mutually supporting. Coldly, I now assessed her as merely a useful but often infuriating adjunct to my personal life. We were on the whole sensible companions. We left one another a certain freedom, and so we were able to endure our proximity. Such was our relationship. Stated thus, it did not seem very significant for the understanding of the universe. Yet in my heart I knew that it was so. Even the cold stars, even the whole cosmos with all its inane immensities, could not convince me that this, our prized atom of community, imperfect as it was, short-lived as it must be, was not significant. But could this indescribable union of ours really have any significance at all beyond itself? Did it, for instance, prove that the essential nature of all human beings was to love rather than to hate and fear? Was it evidence that all men and women the world over, though circumstance might prevent them, were at heart capable of supporting a worldwide love-knit community? And further, did it, being itself a product of the cosmos, prove that love was in some way basic to the cosmos itself? And did it afford, through its own felt intrinsic excellence, some guarantee that we too, its frail supporters, must in some sense have eternal life? Did it, in fact, prove that love was God, and God awaiting us in his heaven? No. Our homely, friendly, exasperating, laughter-making, undecorated, though most prized community of spirit, proved none of these things. It was no certain guarantee of anything but its own imperfect rightness. It was nothing but a very minute, very bright epitome of one out of the many potentialities of existence. I remembered the swarms of the unseeing stars. I remembered the tumult of hate and fear and bitterness which is man's world. I remembered, too, our own not infrequent discordancy. And I reminded myself that we should very soon vanish like the flurry that a breeze has made on still water. Once more there came to me a perception of the strange contrast of the stars and us. The incalculable potency of the cosmos mysteriously enhanced the rightness of our brief spark of community and of mankind's brief, uncertain venture. And these, in turn, quickened the cosmos. I sat down on the heather. Overhead, obscurity was now in full retreat. In its rear, the freed population of the sky sprang out of hiding star by star. On every side, the shadowy hills of the guest featureless sea extended beyond sight. But the hawk flight of imagination followed them as they curved downward below the horizon. I perceived that I was on a little round grain of rock and metal, filmed with water and with air, whirling in sunlight and darkness. And on the skin of that little grain all the swarms of men, generation by generation, had lived in labor and blindness, with intermittent joy and intermittent lucidity of spirit. And all their history, with its folk wanderings, its empires, its philosophies, its proud sciences, its social revolutions, its increasing hunger for community, was but a flicker in one day of the lives of stars. If one could know whether among that glittering host there were here and there other spirit-inhabited grains of rock and metal, whether man's blundering search for wisdom and for love was a soul and insignificant tremor, or part of a universal movement. 2. Earth among the stars. overhead obscurity was gone. From horizon to horizon, the sky was an unbroken spread of stars. Two planets stared unwinking. The more obtrusive of the constellations asserted their individuality. Orion's four square shoulders and feet, his belt and sword, the plow, the zigzag of Cassiopeia, the intimate Pleiades, all were duly patterned on the sky. The Milky Way, a vague hoop of light, spanned the sky. Imagination completed what mere sight could not achieve. Looking down, I seemed to see through a transparent plant, through heather and solid rock, through the buried graveyards of vanished species, down through the molten flow of basalt, and on into the Earth's core of iron, then on again, still seemingly downwards, through the southern strata to the southern ocean and lands, past the roots of gum trees and the feet of the inverted antipodeans, through their blue, sun-pierced awning of day and out into the eternal night where sun and stars are together. For there, dizzyingly far below me, like fishes in the depth of a lake, lay the nether constellations. The two domes of the sky were fused into one hollow sphere, star-peopled, black, even beside the blinding sun. The young moon was a curve of incandescent wire. The completed hoop of the Milky Way encircled the universe. In a strange vertigo, I looked for reassurance at the little glowing windows of our home. There they still were, and the whole suburb, and the hills. But stars shone through all. It was as though all terrestrial things were made of glass, or of some more limpid, more ethereal vitriosity. Faintly the church clock chimed for midnight. Dimly receding, it tolled the first stroke. Imagination was now stimulated to a new, strange mode of perception. Looking from star to star, I saw the heaven no longer as a jeweled ceiling and floor, but as depth beyond flashing depth of suns. And though for the most part the great and familiar lights of the sky stood forth as our near neighbors, some brilliant stars were seen to be in fact remote and mighty, while some dim lamps were visible only because they were so near. On every side the middle distance was crowded with swarms and streams of stars. But even these now seemed near, for the Milky Way had receded into an incomparably greater distance, and through gaps in its nearer parts appeared vista beyond vista of luminous mists and deep perspectives of stellar populations. The universe in which fate had set me was no spangled chamber, but a perceived vortex of star streams. No, it was more. Peering between the stars into the outer darkness, I saw also, as mere flicks and points of light, other such vortices, such galaxies, sparsely scattered in the void, depth beyond depth, so far afield that even the eye of imagination could find no limits to the cosmical, the all-embracing galaxy of galaxies. The universe now appeared to me as a void wherein floated rare flakes of snow, each flake a universe. Gazing at the faintest and remotest of all the swarm of universes, I seemed by hyper-telescopic imagination to see it as a population of suns. And near one of those suns was a planet, and on that planet's dark side a hill, and on that hill myself. For our astronomers assure us that in this boundless finitude which we call the cosmos, the straight lines of light lead not to infinity but to their source. Then I remembered that, had my vision depended on physical light and not on the light of imagination, the rays coming thus to me round the cosmos would have revealed not myself but events that had ceased long before the earth or perhaps even the sun was formed. But now, once more shunning these immensities, I looked again for the curtained windows of our home, which, though star-pierced, was still more real to me than all the galaxies. But our home had vanished, with the whole suburb, and the hills, too, and the sea. The very ground on which I had been sitting was gone. Instead, there lay far below me an insubstantial gloom, and I myself was seemingly disembodied, for I could neither see nor touch my own flesh. And when I willed to move my limbs, nothing happened. I had no limbs. The familiar interperceptions of my body and the headache which had oppressed me since morning had given way to a vague lightness and exhilaration. When I realized fully the changes that had come over me, I wondered if I had died and was entering some wholly unexpected new existence. Such a banal possibility at first exasperated me. Then, with sudden dismay, I understood that if, indeed, I had died, I should not return to my prized concrete atom of community. The violence of my distress shocked me. But soon I comforted myself with the thought that, after all, I was probably not dead, but in some sort of trance from which I might wake at any minute. I resolved, therefore, not to be unduly alarmed by this mysterious change. With scientific interest, I could observe all that happened to me. I noticed that the obscurity which had taken the place of the ground was shrinking and condensing. The nether stars were no longer visible through it. Soon, the earth below me was like a huge circular tabletop, a broad disk of darkness surrounded by stars. I was apparently soaring away from my native planet at incredible speed. The sun, formerly visible to imagination in a nether heaven, was once more physically eclipsed by the earth. Though by now I must have been hundreds of miles above the ground, I was not troubled by the absence of oxygen and atmospheric pressure. I experienced only an increasing exhilaration and a delightful effervescence of thought. The extraordinary brilliance of the stars excited me, for whether through the absence of obscuring air or through my own increased sensitivity or both, the sky had taken on an unfamiliar aspect. Every star had seemingly flared up into higher magnitude. The heavens blazed. The major stars were like the headlights of a distant car. The Milky Way, no longer watered down with darkness, was an encircling, granular river of light. Presently, along the planet's eastern limb, now far below me, there appeared a faint line of luminosity, which, as I continued to soar, warmed here and there to orange and red. Evidently, I was traveling not only upwards, but eastwards and swinging round into the day. Soon the sun leapt into view, devouring the huge crescent of dawn with his brilliance. But as I sped on, sun and planet were seen to drift apart while the thread of dawn thickened into a misty breath of sunlight. This increased like a visibly waxing moon till half the planet was illuminated. Between the areas of night and day, a belt of shade, warm-tinted, broad as a subcontinent, now marked the area of dawn. As I continued to rise and travel eastwards, I saw the land swing westward along with the day, till I was over the Pacific in high noon. The earth appeared now as a great bright orb hundreds of times larger than the full moon. In its center, a dazzling patch of light was the sun's image reflected in the ocean. The planet's circumference was an indefinite breadth of luminous haze fading into the surrounding blackness of space. Much of the northern hemisphere, tilted somewhat towards me, was an expanse of snow and cloud tops. I could trace parts of the outlines of Japan and China, their vague browns and greens indenting the vague blues and grays of the ocean. Towards the equator, where the air was clearer, the ocean was dark. A little whirl of brilliant cloud was perhaps the upper surface of a hurricane. The Philippines and New Guinea were precisely mapped. Australia faded into the hazy southern limb. The spectacle before me was strangely moving. Personal anxiety was blotted out by wonder and admiration, for the sheer beauty of our planet surprised me. It was a huge pearl set in spangled ebony. It was nacreous. It was an opal. No, it was far more lovely than any jewel. Its pattern and coloring was more subtle, more ethereal. It displayed the delicacy and brilliance, the intricacy and harmony of a live thing. Strange that in my remoteness I seemed to feel as never before the vital presence of earth as of a creature alive but tranced and obscurely yearning to wake. I reflected that not one of the visible features of this celestial and living gem revealed the presence of man. Displayed before me, though visible, were some of the most congested centers of human population. There below me lay huge industrial regions, blackening the air with smoke. Yet all this thronging life and humanly momentous enterprise had made no mark whatever on the features of the planet. From this high lookout, the earth would have appeared no different before the dawn of man. No visiting angel or explorer from another planet could have guessed that this bland orb teemed with vermin, with world-mastering, self-torturing, insipidly angelic beasts.